I'm Lisa Davis. Welcome to It's Your Health on Thinking Out Loud on WUML 91.5 FM. We hear a lot about keeping our bodies physically fit, but what about our brains? How do we improve our brain's performance? To find out, we are joined by a leading neuroscientist and New York Times bestselling author of Mozart's Brain and the fighter pilot, Richard Restak, MD. In Think Smart, a neuroscientist's prescription for improving your brain's performance, Dr. Restak distills the research on the brain and serves up practical, surprising, and illuminating recommendations for warding off neurological decline, cognitive function, and encouraging smarter thinking day to day. Richard Restak, MD, an award-winning neuroscientist and neuropsychiatrist, is clinical professor of neurology at George Washington University's Medical Center. The best-selling author of 18 acclaimed books, also written dozens of articles for publications including the Washington Post and New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and USA Today. A fellow of the American Academy of Neurology, the American Psychiatric Association, and the American Neuropsychiatric Association, he lives and practices in Washington, D.C. Dr. Restak, welcome to It's Your Health on Thinking Out Loud on WUML 91.5 FM.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you. I absolutely loved your book. And in the introduction, you write, quote, "What should I do to keep my brain working at its best?" And you go on to say that being the writer of 18 books about the human brain, you are asked this question quite a bit. And now you are taking your own personal odyssey. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, it's great, and I love writing all the other books because each one has a different focus. But I thought, you know, I think everything should pass what we call the so what test. It's interesting to read about, it's endlessly fascinating to explore and to write about, but there are certain people that when you look at them and they say, what kind of books do you write? You say, well, I write books on the brain. You can see a little eye glaze coming on. They just look upon it as kind of, you know, just too esoteric, and you say, well, you know, this stuff really is very practical in terms of your everyday life, and they'd say, well, give me an example. And I'd say, well, let's see. Suppose you're talking on the telephone and you're involved in a very important conversation, and your secretary comes up and starts talking to you about somebody on the other line, and she thinks you should talk to them. And I say you just can't process these two different pieces of information. Whereas if she comes in and hands you a little note and says Smith is on the other line, you might want to talk to him, you can just barely have to make a little break in the conversation that you're having because you're using two different channels. So that's an example. And then I thought, well, let's get a lot more of these, and let's go around and talk to people that I've interviewed over the years and say to them, what are you personally, now as a neuroscientist, Nobel Prize winner type, what are you doing to enhance your brain? And that's kind of where it went from there.
Oh, that's really cool. And a moment ago, you were referring to working memory. We'll see how well my brain works from reading your book. Is that correct?
Yeah, working.
Yay!
Exactly. You're keeping something, manipulating it. It's like asking you to name the presidents, and that's a test of your general memory. If I say, well, just name the Democratic president, starting with Obama and going back as far as you can, that's selective. I mean, that's working memory, because you've got to hold online the whole list of presidents and then just select the Democrats or the Republicans or whatever you may be asking.
I see. Well, in a little bit, we're going to actually get to ways to improve the working memory. You wrote in the book, quote, "We have learned more about the brain in the past decade than we did in the previous 200 years. Doctor, was there anything that you found particularly fascinating?
Well, the most important thing is we found that the brain is malleable, changeable, and what we call plastic. Not plastic like toys made of plastic, but plastic meaning can be changed. And that's the biggest insight that we've really gotten about the human brain. And with that, we then began to say, well, it's never too late to change it. And that's exactly the insight that propels my book, that you can, you know, learn how to use your brain more efficiently.
Okay. Another thing that I loved is you write, quote, "The pianist, the ballet dancer, and taxi driver, and the surgeon have shaped the brain by virtue of their experiences," and that ties into that plasticity. So their brains are going to work in different ways based on the things that they do.
Well, not only that, but they are actually experience the world differently. Mm-hmm. So we hear the old phrase, same planet, different world. That's what we mean. I mean, when a taxi cab driver listens to a symphony, you know, he just doesn't quite hear it the same way as Yo-Yo Ma does. But I would also imagine that if we got Yo-Yo Ma in a front seat of a taxi cab driving it, he wouldn't be all that terrific around New York. So it's a matter of what your time has been spent on, what you've developed, the circuitry that you have facilitated. And that's all based on life experience, which differs, you know, no two people have the same experience, not even identical twins.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, I have a lot of listeners that have teenagers. Maybe you can make them feel better. Tell us a little bit about the adolescent brain.
Yes. Well, the adolescent brain, of course, is a little bit lagging behind in the development of the executive function, the frontal lobes, prefrontal areas, which where you have things like judgment and being able to evaluate the consequences of your behavior and to look at possible implications of doing and not doing certain things. And that, of course, is the very area where adolescents and teenagers fall down, not even very bright ones. I mean, you'll say, gee, you know, you're like an honor student, and I understand that you were stopped by the police going 80 miles an hour with two or three other people in the car, and nobody had seatbelts on and all that. Well, we had to get to the party. You know, that type thing is something that, you know, the judgment just isn't quite there. It's not a matter of IQ, it's a matter that it just takes time for these maturational processes to take place.
And so what age usually do those changes start?
I mean, the idea of being responsible for your behavior, it's there's all kinds of views of it. I mean, what time do people, what time does the law recognize that a child, adolescent, is responsible? What time does the church say that they're responsible for transgressions and things like that?
Oh, yes.
Historically, there's been big differences of opinion. It's not a like a switch that turns on or off, just a gradual development into being responsible for your behavior, recognizing the implications of what you do and don't do.
Okay. You know, we talk a lot on this show about obesity and being healthy and losing weight and all that good stuff. And I was really surprised to learn that obesity is more associated with cognitive impairment than with age, gender, education, or IQ. Do you, they know why that is?
Isn't that surprising?
I mean, yeah, I did. I was like, what?
Yeah, well, it's apparent the development of amyloid and things like this, particularly in Alzheimer's, is related to diet. That's why diet is very important in terms of brain function. And I give a mentions in the book there about the different types of food.
Yes.
It's not so much that there's a specific brain diet. There isn't that, but there's caloric restriction is important. Keeping, and of course, the part of caloric restriction that applies to most of us is keeping our weight within the normal range. Some people take it beyond that and say, well, let's really go way down, and there's no proof in humans that this is definitely going to increase brain function and longevity, although there are hints that it can happen. We get less insulin output when we eat. The body temperature is a little bit lower if we're sort of severely calorically restricted. And you see that with animals who you test them with extreme caloric restriction. They have that happen too to their insulin and their body temperature. So it's sort of an indirect indication that perhaps we would get that benefit. But I asked an audience of 1,400 people a couple of weeks ago, I said, well, you know, if you had to stay on an 800-calorie diet for the rest of your life on every occasion, no matter how joyful, every celebration, you never could eat more than 800 calories, but you'd be smarter and you'd live another decade, how many would want to do it? And I counted, I think, three hands.
I'm surprised it was even three. We only have a few minutes left, so if you can do a couple exercises. And you wrote that there was one that you start with that's the simplest memory exercise of all, and that's repeating something that has been heard just moments earlier.
Yeah, digit space reward. Read a bunch of numbers into it, six digits, seven digits, eight digits, and then put it away. And then the next day, just play one ring of six digits, stop it, see if you can write them down. See if you can repeat them, then go to seven digits, then you go to eight digits. That's general memory. The working memory we talked about earlier is a little trickier. You have to have your general memory intact to do working memory, because you've got to remember all the facts, but you ought to be able to manipulate them and switch them around. Name all the presidents from Obama back to FDR in alphabetical order. That's interesting, because Eisenhower, who would have been one of the last ones, is suddenly pushed up to the front.
Oh, that would be difficult. For some of us, even just naming the president.
Yeah.
So maybe I shouldn't admit that.
Well, that's the general memory. And you'd say that somebody might say, well, look, I'm not really that interested. I'd do that great in history.
Yeah.
Fine. Well, then let's take baseball. Name all the players of New York Yankees. And after you've named them all, name them in alphabetical order. That's working memory.
Okay, well, my husband says I'm a 1970s jukebox. You name a song, I'll sing it. So I think my daughter gets part of that from me because she is now too. But history, not my strong suit. Now, you write in the book that there is something that is the greatest enemy to people's working memory. What is that?
Well, distraction and not being able to focus and not be able to, but mostly distraction and attention.
Okay, and those are things that you need to work on if you're going to try to strengthen your,
attention
brain.
In the mental sphere is the equivalent of physical endurance in the physical sphere. So whatever sport you may be in, whether you're a golfer, a baseball player, a boxer, football, ice hockey, whatever, you all have to have physical endurance. You build that physical endurance up. Same thing with mental. You have to have attentional abilities. You have to be able to focus. And, of course, we live in an era when this is an endangered part of our lives. I mean, there are individuals that are writing some fairly alarming things about attention. They're comparing it to smoking. For years and years and years, people went without realizing that smoking was very harmful to them. And now suddenly we realize, oh, my gosh, we were really ruining our health. Well, it's somewhat like this distraction. That may be the smoking correlate of now, that we don't realize that we're becoming totally distracted all the time.
Yeah.
By, internet, Twitter, and all these various things. We also put a limitation on the depth of our thinking.
Yeah, and there's too much multitasking. I saw this really interesting PBS special. You probably saw it maybe about a month ago, and it talked about the dangers of multitasking, I can't even say it, and yet all these young people were like, oh, it's great, I can tweet, and I can internet, and I can do my homework and watch TV all at the same time. I'm so bright. It's like, nah, it's not really good.
Yeah, well, you don't really get to a question. It's really hard to figure out, write an 800-word essay on the War of 1812 and get all that from tweeting and Facebook and all that. You'll get a lot of opinions, or there's a few on there that might know anything about the War of 1812, but it's not going to give you a synthesis of something that you're going to write an essay on.
Mm-hmm.
So the only way you're going to get that is to read about it and to think about it and then to get your own point of view about it.
Oh, yeah. Now, I definitely want to mention, because my husband is a studio director for a major game company, that you actually have positive things to say about video games. That will also make our listeners of teenagers feel better.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a convenient, successful means of changing the brain. I mean, actually, your attention, ability to pay attention to things on the periphery, particularly these action games, are really, really improved. So there's been studies shown, actually, by Daphne Bavalier and her student, Sean Green, at the University of Rochester. They've done formal studies showing that you can enhance certain brain function by video games. So I think that this is a helpful way to improve sensory integration.
Oh, that's great. I also read an interesting study about it actually helping surgeons as well. Have you read about that?
Well, yes, because you're doing this in a virtual environment, and hopefully you're not, and you can learn things and get back to that deliberate practice we talked about a few minutes ago and concentrate on those parts of the operation that you're not really good at, or I should say not the operation, but the actual part that's being tested by the video game. A video game is very similar to the simulators that we used to have before. So you can take video games that are very much like being in a situation or flying an airplane or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really fascinating. Well, your book is so amazing. I definitely want to have you come back. It's just, I highly recommend it. And I'm so impressed that you've written 18 books on the brain.
Yeah, well, actually, I have another one that's coming.
Oh, terrific. No, what? Tell us about that.
Well, it's a book I did with Scott Kim, the puzzle master for Discover Magazine. We did a book on puzzles and the brain and how to enhance your brain by being involved in puzzles and things like that.
How can people learn more about you?
Well, I have a website. It has all my books. It's richardrestack.com and www.richardrestack.com. And, each of the different 18 books has a different focus about the brain. That's what's great about the brain. It's variety.
Oh, sure is. And I want to thank you again. And if people want to reach me, they can go to itsyourhealthradio.org. Everyone, keep being healthy. Have a great week. Take care. Bye-bye.